Today on our program, we have Laura Hopman, the Krauss Family Senior Curator at the New Museum in New York City. Thank you very much, Laura, for being part of our program today.
Thank you for asking me, Brainerd.
I'd like to begin by asking you a little bit about your beginnings in the art world. Where is it that you remember first becoming interested in either the arts or in curating?
Well, I'm kind of a special case because I've always wanted to be a museum curator ever since I was a little kid. I grew up in Washington, D.C., and we spent our weekends at the museums. I can remember when I was about four, my mother did an art show in the backyard, and I watched it. So this is something that was part of my DNA from very, very early on.
What was the show that your mother did in the backyard?
We had a neighbor who was a painter, I remember her nailing the paintings to the pine trees in the backyard. I mean, we had a very culturally interested, if not sophisticated, family, and our thing was art. And we went to the museums all the time. So it was something that I always wanted to do, and I focused all my energies as a young person on art.
And what was the first curatorial work you did? Was it something as out of the box as, I mean, I love that, nailing paintings to trees.
No. I went to graduate school in New York City, but before I went to graduate school, I worked in film and video on the Lower East Side, actually right around the corner from where the new museum is now on Rivington Street in a place called Film Video Arts. So I started my art life in film and video and performance because I also worked at a place called Franklin Furnace, which was a performance and a book archive. Then I needed some money, so I was a waitress at the same time. I went back to graduate school a year after I came to New York I came to New York in 1983. And I went back to graduate school for art history in 1984 and started my curatorial career in the midst of graduate school. And my first curatorial job was at the Bronx Museum of the Arts. And for those who don't know that place, it's a museum of contemporary art that was founded in the late 1970s as part of the largest of the Johnson administration's Great Society. And it's a place for emerging artists. And I spent 3 years there, and I remember my last year I made 300 studio visits. Can you imagine? So it really started me, gave me a vocabulary certainly of the regional artists in the New York area from my Bronx Museum experience.
And that was in the 80s when you were doing the studio visits?
The late 1980s, yeah. In between, I also worked for Merce Cunningham, which was really interesting. I had spent 18 months with Merce because he was a dancer who was very involved in media, particularly. So I worked in the film and video department there for a while. And I also did some time at the Whitney Museum in the film and video department, which I really loved. So I had a little bit of experience, but not in curatorial capacity. My first curatorial job was at the Bronx Museum. And from there, I went to MoMA, which was quite a strange experience, but I was very lucky because I had this huge vocabulary of emerging artists, and I went to an institution which at that time didn't know anything about emerging artists. So I really had I don't think I had any skill. I'm sure I didn't have any skill, but I certainly had a vocabulary that was very useful at MoMA. So, yes, and for MoMA, I spent 6 years at MoMA in the drawing department and did a lot of exhibitions for a curator, a very, very junior curator. I did a heck of a lot of exhibitions. And then I did the 2004-05 Carnegie International, which took 3 years of my life, and then came home to New York and decided to return to, not to a big institution, but to the new museum, because the new museum was opening a new building here on the Bowery and creating a whole new staff, and gave us an opportunity to sort of envision a new kind of contemporary art museum for New York.
And it sounded like
that's my life in a nutshell. I've only done this.
But you've been between several mediums. You were the drawing curator at MoMA, and it sounded like before then you were focused a lot on video and film.
You know, I was focused a lot on performance first and video and film, not because I liked it, but because that was where I could get a job. And it was super interesting for me, and I'm just very lucky that I have been active in an era where in contemporary art that kind of division between mediums doesn't necessarily have to dictate what you do in your life. I mean, I worked in the film and video department at the Whitney, but a few years after I worked there, they dissolved that department altogether so that there's no kind of apartheid now between mediums in a museum like the Whitney Museum. And even the MoMA, which is sort of famous for its divisions. I was a drawing curator and learned a lot about drawing, but I did a lot of exhibitions with all kinds of different mediums. I did the retrospective of the artist Yayoi Kusama, who's a great, great works on paper person, but a magnificent painter and a performer and a filmmaker and all those other things. I did a show called Drawing Now, which included the work of, how many artists did I have? I think I had something like 24 artists. There were 8 sections. And they were wonderful. They are wonderful artists, but not all of them. Most of them are probably not known just as drawing people. There was, I don't know, Elizabeth Payton, Chris Ofili, John Curran, the sort of heavy hitter figurative painters of my generation were in that show. You'd think of it more of as an exhibition of drawing, but really coming from the vocabulary of people who are painters. Not exclusively, but most of them.
Right. You talked about doing 300 studio visits, and I'd like to talk about that a little bit because I'm interested, and I think everyone's interested in how you selected those artists. How did you choose 300 artists? Where do you
That's a very good question, but I have kind of a boring answer, but we can talk about it in another way. For that particular job, the Bronx Museum had and still has a program called AIM, which is an acronym for Artists in the Marketplace. It's a program for emerging artists where every week they come to the museum, meet one another, and learn practical information on how to survive as an artist in New York, like how to do your taxes. And at that time, how to make a portfolio of your slides or something to send to galleries. And the museum arranges meetings with curators, other curators, as well as gallerists, as well as tax people, as all kinds of things. And at the end of this 9-week program, you have an exhibition at the museum. So you leave the museum. This was the thinking, at least at the time, and maybe still now. You leave that museum program with a kind of community that you meet, some sort of life skills for artists, and an exhibition on your resume with a catalog. So the year that I did most of my studio visits, or the year and a half that I was there, I was making an exhibition that that commemorated the 20th anniversary of this program. I think it's now 30 years old. I can't remember. This is the 20th, the 15th or the 20th anniversary of this program. So I visited the alumni of the AIM program, plus then the groups of emerging artists. So there was a kind of matrix. But how do you choose? Well, I've had one tried and true method my entire career, and that is that I ask other artists. And I'm married to an artist. I've been married to an artist for 15 years. And he was, before we were married and while during our marriage, has been, you know, a font of information. So I have always, always done that, whether I was working at the Bronx Museum or the Museum of Modern Art or even at the New Museum. I always rely on artists to tell me what artists to go look at.
Huh, that's very interesting.
Doesn't everybody do that?
Well, they have different methods. Some people do say they do both. They have artists to rely on, other people. We're talking about meeting people when they're out. And it's an interesting question because one of the things that I'm finding from talking to different people in the art world is, especially the people who have been in it quite a long time, is how the world has so radically changed from the 70s and even early 80s to now.
In terms
of so many more artists and a very different landscape, even without this recession, financially for artists.
It's mostly because we have I'm sorry to break in, but the first thing I would think of was the idea that we are in a post-studio landscape, and particularly in New York, because it's so expensive to establish a studio here. So there's a lot of people who have a post-studio practice. During the boom, there were a lot of artists that you would visit, and often, very often, one would go to a studio, and there would be no work there. You would be looking at it through reproductions because they had, for better or for worse, schlepped it to their gallery for sale. So it was never. It was rarely there. So that I think that over the years, what's changed for me in terms of studio visits is that it has at certain moments really I don't want to say devolved because that has too much value judgment, but it's evolved or become a kind of meeting as opposed to a kind of discussion over objects.
Let's talk a little bit more about that. It's become more of a meeting than a discussion over objects.
In many cases, yes. And it used to be when you were working with somebody, when you were talking to somebody with a conceptual practice, that was typical. I mean, I remember when I first met Gabriel Orozco, and I met him under other circumstances. I met him in an elevator, and we kind of became friends. But he used to, when he lived in the East Village, he used to meet people in the cafe in Veselka, that Ukrainian restaurant. That used to be the place where he went to visit Gabriel. The same with Mauricio Catalan. When he moved to New York City, he lived in this tiny little apartment. And that was a show that I did in 1998 at the Museum of Modern Art. I worked with Mauricio, and we would not meet at his apartment. He never had a studio. We would meet in this sort of crappy East Village coffee shop and talk about things. There was nothing to see. It was all concept, no precept.
Right.
But both of those artists are my generation. Gabriel and I are about the same age, and Mauricio is a little tiny bit older than we are. But the same, actually, with Rickert Chirivanija is an artist who I've known ever since I was at the Bronx Museum. He was one of my 300 studio visits that early time. And he was the first project that I did at the Museum of Modern Art when I got there. And I remember how we talked about it in Tompkins Square Park. I mean, that was the way we sort of worked. So all three of those guys were sort of post-studio, and that was my first experience of that, not going into a basement or a studio, or, you know, a place where there are things, there are paintings to see or something. But as the 90s became the 2000s, and as the art market heated up so much, and the studio visits became more and more, in a way, they're sort of bizarre because you really were trying to sort of chase the objects, and you more often than not, you didn't find the objects with the artist in her studio. You found them in the back room of their gallery or in some other exhibition space, but mostly a commercial exhibition space. I mean, even at art schools, I remember very, very well, maybe up until about 4 years ago, going to art schools and having a case of, you know, some people not even having very much work if I wasn't there for their, you know, MFA exhibition. Some of their work would have been already dispersed into the commercial ecosystem.
That's
a funny thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
What?
It is. But
it's weird. I mean, even to talk about it is weird.
Right, but has that changed also since then?
Well, you know, I'm talking about very recent history now. I can't tell you absolutely whether it has or not, but I can see some changes. I mean, just as I go to a lot of art schools, and I really treasure that ability. People ask me to go to places all over the country, and also sort of postgraduate programs like the CORE program. I just came back from there in Houston. And I think as of this year, I do see that there is a kind of changed atmosphere, a sort of less charged atmosphere in the studios of younger artists or emerging artists, if you will. I do. There's more stuff there. There's less of a push to get it out of there. There's less of an object orientation. That shouldn't be a surprise to people who are looking at contemporary work now. There's less painting. You know, and I'm a painting curator, I guess, but it became, the ubiquity of paint became almost lugubrious for someone like me. That's hard to say because I never thought I could get enough of it. But I've noticed in art schools now there's a little bit of a chilling out now, which I think is really positive, you know, that artists whose practice might not have been conducive to painting heretofore were, I saw, in some cases, making paintings, for example. And I haven't seen that in the past year and a half or so, which has been great.
Right. Now, you talked about this being post-studio environment, such as what happened with Rickert and Gabrielle. They were all conceptual artists, though, which makes more sense. There's so many other artists who I would think are, I mean, who aren't conceptual artists, who also have a studio practice, but it's very difficult to have a studio in Manhattan.
Yes, that's the second. Yes, I completely agree with you, and that's another contribution to the phenomenon of the post-studio practice. you're making art in your living room as opposed to your commodious loft, you know, in Soho. I mean, even I came to New York in 1983, and I say this to people all the time because it's a long time ago, but it doesn't seem that long ago to me. But when I came in 1983, I worked on Rivington Street, but I could never afford to live on the Bowery or Rivington Street, even in 1983. The rents and those bigger spaces, loft spaces that artists traditionally would move into were they cost real money. And it's important to remember that those kinds of big spaces cost real money up until the late 70s. So you have to be of a generation and a half older even than me, I feel ancient, to have been able to have had the shot of a space in Manhattan, so say in Soho or downtown, or even in the East Village. The East Village was cheap, but it didn't have the very big spaces that I remember, you know, that you think of in your mind's eye that maybe a sculptor would need, for example. So my generation might have lived in the East Village, but they were already moving to Williamsburg, where the big spaces were. I did a lot of studio visits, and I'm not saying I didn't. It's just that in the 2000s, say, past 10 years, it's not a typical cliched notion of a curator going to an artist studio. There are plenty of them in Bushwick. I've been in Queens and in the Bronx, and but it became a pretty rare experience to go into a studio and see a person's, you know, a person's oeuvre right there. You can go and see one painting or one object before it goes to the gallery. I don't know. Interesting. Or they didn't have a place for a studio, so they have made it at a residency or something like that.
So now that we're in the 2000s, what is happening with studio visits? Are you going to Brooklyn more? Is it less feasible? Is there a different kind of process because there's been that whole shift in
I think I don't know. I mean, I think artists are very intrepid, and I'm very admiring of the way that artists manage to figure things out. And of course, you know, after a certain generation, you're not going to have a studio in Manhattan. After a certain generation, you're not going to have a studio in the closer areas of Brooklyn either. And you know that people push further and further out and manage to find places that they can work in. And I think that as the discourse evolves, so does the kind of work that people do. I think when the recession hit, everybody was saying, oh, the work will change. And it didn't change immediately. You know, people who were painters didn't stop painting because people weren't buying them anymore. But I think that now we're about almost 2 years out, a year and a half out from the biggest crash, the biggest economic moment, problematic moment. I do think that there is that, especially very young artists who are just trying to figure out their vocabulary are finding, I think probably, I don't have to ask some, that the pressure might be off a little for that sort of unrelenting pressure to make an object and set it to market.
Yeah, I think that's the case. I think I find artists do talk about the pressure is off, but the way the pressure is on and where it's always been is to earn enough money to continue staying where you are or to pursue your practice because of jobs being more scarce, or even if the jobs aren't more scarce, there's an even greater push to earn money and keep your studio close enough to Manhattan or major museums so that you can be involved in a metropolitan.
I think that's an interesting question. It's something I talk with my husband about all the time. This question of whether it's very important to be close to the market, to the central marketplace that is New York City, because there are other marketplaces too. But is it important? How important is it now at this moment to be close to the center in terms of economics? I understand it's good to be close to a center because it's great to be meet with other artists and, I mean, have a community and not feel like some weirdo, you know, not feel like some Martian and in a community that doesn't understand what you're doing or need what you're doing. But economically, how important is it to be near, do you think?
Well, I know that I graduated school and I lived on Block Island, Rhode Island for a little while, which was completely off the path. And I established
mm-hmm.
a small gallery and a magazine out there, and you know, mostly artists that I knew from New York came out there, and we had a gallery for the summer. And my experience, though I had really an idyllic setup, I could work a few days a week doing carpentry and spend the rest of the day in a beautiful studio that was something like a giant loft space. It was a giant barn. The problem I was experiencing was that I felt, even though it was a very tolerant community and I knew many people in the community, I felt that somehow it was creatively constricting. And I think that had to do with the fact that it was a very small community and everybody knows what you're doing. And it sounds maybe not completely clear, but when I came to New York, and it was a difficult decision because I did live this life that I likened to being a retired artist. I felt like, I'm only 22, but I feel like a retired artist. I've got this big studio on a beautiful island, and I can make all the work I want, but I didn't feel an involvement with a community. And it was more than that, though. When I came to New York, I felt, and the fact that, of course, I had friends there, but the fact that generally you know nobody in New York, it's such a giant city, you have a sense
mm-hmm.
of anonymity, that I felt anything was possible. And so, I mean, at that point, I did open up a storefront in the East Village and began giving out services. That was something I couldn't have thought of, or I could have thought of it, but it wouldn't really have been possible to do in the very small community I was in. And my theory on that is it has to do with a very small community is somehow creatively claustrophobic, as opposed to a giant community like New York is the opposite because of a sense of anonymity. And does that make sense?
No, I completely agree with you. And I think that it has nothing to do with money is what you're saying, really. It has everything to do with, I hate this term, but finding a context for yourself so that you're, I mean, that you make sense and what you do and who you are makes sense with the community that you live in. And yeah, New York is huge and there's all these different art worlds, micro communities, which is something that we are exhaustively looking at right now. I mean, we're having this sort of contemporary art self-examination here about the micro communities in the city. But it's possible to find an audience, if you will, for what you're doing and not be alone, I think.
So I mean, it's
to say with curators, by the way, it's great to be a curator in wherever, you know, I grew up in Langley, Virginia. It's great to be a curator in Langley, Virginia, and it's important. But it's easier to be a curator in a community that is looking for contemporary art exhibitions to go to.
Exactly.
It's easier. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think there's a certain amount of support. I mean, I don't want to focus too much on New York, although I guess New York is the focus of the art world or much of it, but it was my feeling also that in New York, my wife's from Spain, she's from Madrid, and she feels that New York encourages people to do anything. It does seem that there are limitless possibilities for artists, whether there are or not, whereas small communities that I was in for a little while or Madrid in Spain, she felt is quite the opposite, that everything, kind of grandiose ideas are thought of as improbable and not worth pursuing. There isn't a lot of support there for that.
Mm-hmm.
And New York somehow seems to support or has that feeling, I think, of offering support for all those things. And I don't just think it obviously happens. More unusual, certainly projects from my point of view, happen in New York, whereas they may not happen at all in other cities.
Mm-hmm.
But
I agree with you.
I guess one thing that I'd like to talk with really in closing is there are artists graduating now and there are artists emerging into this world, just, you know, thousands every year, and many of them are attracted to New York or as near to it as they get. And just in our discussion briefly, we can see this kind of expansion outside of New York. Like you're saying, generation to generation, it's, you know, economically it looks like it's impossible to stop that engine, that people are being pushed out of the city. And just you know, meeting a curator or applying for shows or becoming part of the art world is very much a mystery to a lot of artists. Where do they begin? Where do you think an artist begins in terms of moving?
It's a good closing question because it comes around to the beginning of the conversation, and I have the same answer. I think that artists begin making a world for themselves among other artists, and any way that you can become a part of a, if you can commune with other artists, is I think where you're going to find your ideological or your artistic home, and there are lots of ways to do that. You can become involved in a postgraduate program, like the CORE program or Skowhegan, or even a less ambitious one, maybe a regional one like the one that I mentioned that the Bronx Museum still runs, the AIM program, which is one that's not necessarily, it's not a residency, so you don't have to go live somewhere. I think that you could go to graduate school. I know that that's been de rigueur now for at least 20 years for professional artists. I mean, most professional artists that I see have master's degrees, although it probably started in my generation in a little bit, because the artists who are a little bit older than me don't have those master's degrees and didn't feel it necessary. It's very similar with curators, though. There are curatorial programs all over the place, and when I started working, I knew that I wanted to get an art history degree. I never thought I needed a curatorial degree, so I'm a kind of old-school curator in that way. I'm an art historian and not a curatorial studies person. But, yeah, you find your community that way. I think it's great, absolutely amazing and great that that horrible system that was seemed to have been in place when I started out, where you had to go, like an artist would have to go to a gallery and submit her slides, I thought was revolting to have somebody like hold up a sheet of slides and look at it and go, you know, yes or no. I think that the world's, the communities are much more permeable now. The museum community, the commercial art world in New York City, the non-commercial art world in New York City, the kind of commercial art world, there's a lot of hybrids too. And that kind of judgment, I don't think, is so much a part of people's lives anymore. And I'm very happy about that, because that was just awful, I think, personally. It was an awful way to look at art or make those snap judgments, and it was an awful way to for artists to have to submit. I think now, not collectors, but art dealers, for example, at least over the past 10 years, have been on the hunt for artists. So I think the burden of finding artists were more on these people who realized that there was this very lively market for emerging artists. What's going to happen now? I don't know. I don't know if my art dealer colleagues are running around looking for the next big thing, but I certainly know that curators are very focused on emerging artists, want to look for new talent, and are very interested in finding, you know, gathering information. Right. So I don't know. I mean, I have to ask some young artists, but I think that I wouldn't say it's easier. It's just that some of the burdens that were there before aren't there anymore, I don't think. What do you think?
Right, and you mentioned smaller communities as well as going back to school, graduate programs. I'm thinking also of many artists who are graduating from MFA programs and are still wondering, reach a curator. And there's AIM programs, which makes sense, but
yeah, I mean, there's the CORE program down in Houston, and others like it, things like that, residencies. I know a lot of artists do that. I think that the art schools are thriving now because so many people are interested in teaching. And it used to be, on the East Coast, it used to be problematic. I mean, I wouldn't, at least in my time. But now I think that almost every artist that I know would probably kill for a teaching job in New York. It's a wonderful way to be in touch with all the sort of new ideas that are coming up, and also have academic stimulation, if you will. Yeah.
Right. And where do you meet new artists now? You said mostly through recommendations from other artists.
I still do that. I go to art schools. I go to programs like the LMCC, the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council. I make an appearance at the AIM program. I didn't do it last year, but pretty much every year for the past 20 years, I go up there. The Bronx Museum has this show every summer. For me, it's a kind of organic process and a big challenge because you're most comfortable in your generation and those artists who are closest to your generation, and it's a challenge. But I was very lucky. For example, I participated in this triennial that we did here at the new museum called Younger Than Jesus. So it was the millennial generation of artists. We looked at 500 artist portfolios. It was fantastic, from all over the world. So if you're lucky enough to, as a curator, to be involved in a project like that, then you immediately have a vocabulary. I spent 3 years traveling all over the world for the Carnegie International. And they're not exactly emerging artists. They're fairly well-known artists who are part of that kind of biennial circuit, but I certainly learned a lot. I travel a lot. It's important to do that, to get out of your seat,
right.
Get away from the galleries. Because the galleries are a font of information, absolutely. I mean, they often know way before we know interesting artists. But I got to say, and this is something that I have been wagged my finger at some of our very beloved art critics for, the assumption that curators find their material in the art galleries drives me bananas. Because more often than not, we find our material before the gallerists do, and they find their artists through us, which is fine. I mean, I think it's all great. It's all great. But the criticism, I don't buy the criticism that many curators or all curators just follow what the gallerists do, because in a lot of cases, the gallerists are following what the curators do, and it's sometimes a simultaneous thing that you see. You see an artist's work in a museum and a gallery at the same time. But so yeah, I don't need, and I think almost every other contemporary curator would tell you this. I don't need the imprimatur of a famous gallery for me to be interested in somebody's work. That's for sure.
That's refreshing to hear. I'm sure to a lot of people.
But everybody would say that. I think I don't think I'm alone.
I don't think you're alone as a curator, perhaps, but I think many artists do believe that that's exactly what they need on their resume in order.
I think for a broader population and certainly for the collector class, it certainly doesn't hurt. Although there's a whole area of collecting that's been plumped up over the past 10 or 15 years that concentrates on lesser known artists. People really pride themselves, collectors really pride themselves in finding new talent before anybody else. It's a big deal for a lot of contemporary collectors to do that, the hunt.
Right.
So, the world's all turned upside down now, really. It's really interesting. We didn't even get into that. But, you know, I have one job. I'm very lucky. I get to interact with artists. I've done it my entire career. It's what I wanted to do, and I get to do it. I get to travel, and I get to look at beautiful things and try to understand them, interesting things, and try to understand them. I'm very, very lucky. But my job, the thing that I dedicate myself to, is trying to create a context and interpret these beautiful and interesting things for a wider public. That's what I do. That's what
Is there anything you'd like to say in closing to the many artists who are listening to this broadcast?
Well, I'm glad you're there. Because if you weren't, I wouldn't be. And it's just, I don't know, yeah. That's what I'd like to say.
Laura, thank you so much for being part of this today. It was very, very insightful and interesting to talk to you, and I really appreciate your time.
You didn't let me plug my... Oh, I forgot. I wanted to plug my next project.
Oh, please do.
Yes, okay. I am a contemporary curator, and I always have been. But my next exhibition will be of a lesser-known, if not unknown artist, unrepresented artist, and a dead one. And his name is Brian Geisen, and he was a great psychonaut, a psychological, a traveler, a painter, a concrete poet, a performer, an amateur esoteric, and a friend and collaborator with many, many artists, and he died in 1986. And I've spent almost 3 years of my life researching this very fascinating character, and I hope that people will come to the new museum in July to see this exhibition.
Well,
it's called Dream Machine.
I've never heard
he's
that
great.
Term psychonaut before.
Psychonaut.
is that what you said?
Yes, I did. Have you ever heard of Brian Geisen?
No, I haven't.
Ring a bell a little bit? He's one of the best known unknown artists in the world. He collaborated with many people, but his most famous collaboration, which was a lifelong one, was with William Burroughs. And together they created a collage book of methods called The Third Mind, which they made in 1965. But he also created a work, the only work of art that you look at with your eyes closed, called The Dream Machine, which works on the flicker effect and allows you to, in short, paint pictures in your head, so without paint or canvas. So
now
come one, come all to the new museum to see Brian Geisen this summer.
That sounds fascinating. I will. That's a wonderful place to leave it. Thank you again, Laura, so much for
You're
being
welcome.
With us. Okay, now hold on just a second. I'm going to stop the recording.